slightly softer, but it's like very jiggly.
Okay.
Is it recording?
Yeah. Okay. Can you talk?
Check, check.
Check, check. So I'll be talking from here. Mm-hmm. I do have a kind of a frog in my throat, so I hope it comes through clear enough.
I think so. I can hear it.
You can hear it? Okay, mm-hmm. Perfect. Cool.
If you think it's getting too foggy, signal me and I'll clear my throat.
I'll raise my hand at either of you mm-hmm. two if I
Sounds
need to.
Sounds good. Okay, so let's get started. Hello, my name is Mariana Araujo. Today is Thursday, October 6, 2016 at 5:20 in the afternoon. I am in Vinton, Virginia with Mary Bunke. And we're interviewing Mary for the Southwest Virginia LGBTQ Oral History Project. So, Mary, where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania. That's up on Lake Erie. And I'm the youngest of three children. My father was the chief design engineer of a small company that built very large steam engines for power plants and lake freighters. And his engines were good enough that this company thrived all during the Depression, and during I was born in 29, and so my mother used to say I brought on the Depression, but I never really knew about it until I was in college and took an economics course. So I had a very comfortable childhood. My parents were Presbyterian. My father was an avowed atheist from the time I knew him, so I had a choice theologically, and a very comfortable childhood. I went to mostly public schools, but then to a Catholic girls' seminary for high school. Very small, very poor academically, which I later discovered because I went to Wellesley College, which is one of the top women's colleges in the country, and I really had a major adjustment to make there. But I was always rabble-rousing a little bit, even in high school. We were testing restaurants and talking to them if they weren't serving Negroes. You can tell the vintage of a person, whether they say the nasty N-word or Negro or Black or Afro-American. It's by generation, yes. So I was very active in the civil rights movement. By then, I was married to John Benke and had three young children. We were living in Cleveland Heights, and we more or less helped desegregate Cleveland Heights. There were some home bombings in our neighborhood, and actually, I had gone to the big march on Washington in 1963 when Martin Luther gave his I Have a Dream speech. My Unitarian Church Social Action Committee rented a bus, chartered a bus. We sat up all night, marched all day, sat up all night getting home. And that really motivated me to get active in the civil rights movement. So we started a group that first met in our living room with about 35 women, and 2 weeks later with 50. Cleveland Heights is kind of an egg-headed community just up the hill from Case Western Reserve. And so we had a kind of a ready membership for that group. And that's where I really learned about calling meetings, talking to community leaders, and we got the schools to make their bylaws more Black-friendly, and we got the city council to hire a person to... we were showing homes to Blacks in our basically white neighborhood, and that got some people pretty upset. We got the city to hire somebody to support that effort. And it was a very successful experience. So then I went back to school. Oh, I had graduated from college before I was married. But I went back to school at Case Western Reserve and got a master's degree in the School of Social Work, but not in one-to-one interviewing. It was in what we called a community organization. as CO. And I knew that that's what I enjoyed doing. And by then, my husband discovered that our activities were not helping his career any at General Electric. So he resigned, and we moved to Dayton, Ohio, where I continued my civil rights activities and raising our children. And let's see, I didn't get into gay issues until our middle kid finished freshman year at Oberlin and came out as a lesbian. And I thought for a while, oh, if we just hadn't sent her to Oberlin, which was a very liberal college, maybe she wouldn't be gay. So that's the kind of innocent background I started from. And of course, I learned pretty quickly that that had nothing to do with it. And 19 years later, she came out again as a transsexual. Both times we had not a clue, and have any clue she was going to come out at either time, and knew nothing about being gay or transsexual. So they were both pretty intense learning experiences for my husband and me. So we were married and living in Cleveland Heights and had three small children. And that's when I got into the civil rights movement.
So, you were talking about, you know, your children, and I was just wondering, you know, you talked about how you didn't know about it at the time. How was it for your, I guess, other kids or some members in your family, your friends, your support network while you were learning?
Well, we were very lucky because I was a social worker, and we were Unitarians and very liberal in our theology and our social issues. And so it was not, neither time was not a problem for our family. It was scary because we didn't know much about it or what was in store for our kid. And we worried that she and then he would have a lot of problems to face. But actually, he was very lucky. He came out as a transsexual while our other son was in the hospital for leukemia, and was what my husband calls a challenging year. And we thought it was not good timing on then Heidi's part to come out as a transsexual just when Mark was so ill, life-threatening, really. But we've often said it was like having two suitcases to carry, you know. You might as well be carrying two as just one. And we weren't free to worry full-time about either one. So we were very lucky. They are both very healthy, happy adults now. So we got through a tough period in our life.
Do you think being so involved with the civil rights movement, and do you have any lessons that came from that kind of translated to your involvement with LGBTQ rights and going through this challenging year with your family?
Well, it was because of our kid and his journey that I really got involved in PFLAG and found it just so interesting. So I guess if I had any advice to other parents, it's learn about what your kid is going through. Read, talk to friends, make new friends. If some of your friends are not able to accept this, then go easy on them. They get to take their time understanding and accepting. And but then you need to find some support for yourself as well as for your kid. Yeah. So I worked in as a social worker most of my career, planning and starting new programs. I started a lunch program for senior citizens in Warren, Ohio, and administered a grant for another agency setting up homes for low-income people in middle-class neighborhoods. That was a challenge for them and for the neighborhood. So I fell into an active role quite easily. It was my life, actually. I describe myself as a born rabble-rouser, working on various issues. Right now I'm thinking of getting a little more active in the Right to Die movement. It's also closer to home. Yes. But when we retired in 1990 and moved from Ashtabula, Ohio, up in the northeast corner of Ohio, we traveled around and finally selected the Roanoke area for our retirement. But I was bereft of a job and a career that I loved and needed something to do. And I started taking little seminars out at Roanoke College, Hollins, and then leading some workshops there, and asked at one point if I could do a seminar on gay issues for families. And the director of the Women's Center said, well, she would have to inquire, and it went all the way up to the president, and the message came back down, go ahead, it would be all right, they would be glad to sponsor such a seminar. And so we advertised that seminar and said, and if there's interest, we would continue meeting. And so six brave people came to that little seminar, and we did indeed continue meeting, and that became the B-Flag chapter then. And I think that was about in 1992. I had moved here in 1990, and it took me a year or two to find support for doing such things.
Was there a particular reason why Roanoke was the place that you and your husband picked to move to?
We had a list of about 10 things we wanted in our retirement community. We didn't have any friends or family here, but we wanted a Unitarian church. I wanted a beautiful area, hills and greenery and lakes and so forth. We wanted good health care services, transportation, cultural facilities. We like classical music and so forth. So that's how we settled on this area. And we've never regretted it, and we've met a number of other people who have moved here because of the facilities and the beauty of the area without necessarily knowing anyone here.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I found it really interesting with the group in Hollins and the workshops, and then that leading to PFLAG. Could you tell us a little bit more about how that got started and how you got involved in your activism in the community to get the chapter started in Roanoke?
Well, the six people that were involved in the initial startup all had friends. And as I said, I'm a Unitarian, and we started meeting at our church, and my church was very supportive. And so some of my church friends started coming, and then some gay folks. These were all parents and families, but then some gay folks started coming as well, and they had friends. So it just grew by word of mouth. And it was not a huge group. I mean, if we got up to a dozen people at a meeting or whatever, we would usually have some kind of a program, a speaker, and a discussion, and refreshments. And then we would break it up into a couple of smaller groups. One group would be a support group for people who had problems or questions or wanted to share their story, and confidentially in a small group. And we always had a leader for that group. And then the other people stayed on either to talk about the issues or political situation or whatever was of interest at that time. And we continued for about 12 years. And then we stopped getting new people. And we decided that to fold our tent and close down the chapter. There were no new people coming for maybe 6 months. And we were weary, I think, at that point. And we thought also that gay people and gay issues had become much better accepted. And that was part of the reason that people were not, we no longer got mothers crying on our shoulder at meetings as we did many times before that. But we were quite an active group. PFLAG talks about support, education, and advocacy. And support is meeting and hugging and telling gay folks who didn't want to be gay that they were beautiful just the way they are, and it's okay, and you can have a good life, and so forth. Education, we dispersed a lot of pamphlets and printed material, and we had speakers coming in talking about various aspects of being gay, medical issues, political issues, so forth. And we had various gay people speaking about their own experiences. We sent out letters to churches encouraging ministers to send us their gay folks who were hurting and needed support. We sent letters to doctors when we discovered that there were no medical facilities in Roanoke for particularly for transsexual people who were traveling all the way, you know, with a 100-mile radius of Roanoke to get to the hormones that they needed and so forth. We had an annual fundraising meeting. It was a dinner meeting, and then we all contributed our giveaway stuff and sold it, auctioned it off, and we raised money, and we gave away $500 scholarships to one or two or three gay students every year. We were quite active. When the Boy Scouts started refusing to let gay people become members, and they wouldn't let a gay man be a troop leader, we went to talk to the Boy Scouts. And when there was a police sting in the park, and a number of gay men were arrested, you know, we went to talk to city council and to the mayor and so forth. And one of our members was a out gay attorney, Sam Garrison, and he represented the men who had been arrested, and he had amazing day in court, where we all came and packed the gallery, so to speak. Of course, he didn't win that case, but educated a few people in the process. Let me see, city council, mayor, sting in the park. Okay, so we were a very active chapter. The current group, which is just pulled out of PFLAG, I think has been a very nice support group, but they have not been interested in outreach and advocacy, political process, that sort of thing. And now they are no longer a PFLAG group.
I think from, you know, you were talking about the 6 months that there were so many people coming because, you know, things were getting better, and you talked about how it might close down. What made you, you know, everyone decide to stay? And then after that, did you see, like, you know, new members coming, or, like, you know, how do you see, I guess, the issues and things that worry about people, like getting better, maybe getting worse through your time with people?
Well, we thought the country was becoming much more accepting of gays and gay issues, and that PFLAG was not as much needed as it was originally, and that since new people were not coming, we figured that being gay was no longer quite as big a tragedy as people originally thought it was. So that we felt we were not as much needed and not accomplishing much. So, and I'm in favor that some groups outlive their usefulness and just go on meeting because they like being together, but we all had other things to do. You know, we were active people. So we didn't feel this was a good use of our time anymore. I'm not sure we were correct. I think maybe if we had done some more active outreach, we could have perked up the group again. But we were tired by then.
And that was what year?
That would have
Around what time?
That would have been about 2004 or 5, in that range. Mm. We moved here in 1990. We started the group in 92, and I know it went for about 12 years. We had a very big meeting for our 10-year anniversary, and then after that it sort of petered off. So mm. I think we closed down about 2004 or 5.
Just to go back a little, can you, you know, while we were reading about it, can you tell me a little bit about the PFLAG newspaper and how that got started and how that kind of outreach to other people and then, I guess,
talking
newsletter.
About the National PFLAG newsletter?
No, this was the Roanoke one.
Right. Oh, okay. I had forgotten that we did a newsletter. I did a newsletter. well, we wanted something to be able to distribute in the community. And for the people who came to visit us to be able to take home to their family. And something to mail out to people who had come in the past and were no longer coming. So it was... it was our way of outreach into the community. And I'm trying to think, what in the world did we print in that newsletter? And I must have copies of it somewhere, but I don't know where.
Well, one of the things I think we noticed, and it was, there was a helpline, and it was your phone number from your home. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know.
Yeah, I think that was a fellow by the name of John Goodhart, who is almost as old as I am, but he was very good at answering the phone and supporting, providing warm fuzzy support for people. And he's the one who coordinated the support part of the group, you know, after the speaker and refreshments, and then we broke into smaller groups. He coordinated the support group. And I guess I more or less stuck with the issues and organizational kinds of things.
Right. And when people, did you get a lot of phone calls also, you know, in that side of, or was it just an added?
No, we would have maybe 2 or 3 a month. Not a lot. Mm. And I was very familiar with covering the phone, but I was happy to have someone else do it. I had previously, when I retired, I was 60, I retired a few years early, I was the director of a 24-hour crisis line in Ashtabula, Ohio. So I was very familiar with running telephone support.
What were one of the things you found challenging or maybe also really helpful in this movement to have a support line of people to call and talk about issues with someone?
Well, people who called the support line were people who were just beginning to realize they were gay. And they had not found a gay support, much gay support. Frequently scared to tell their, not out to their family. And the hardest thing a gay person used to have to do was to come out to their family, particularly to parents. Siblings were sometimes easier, or aunts or uncles or cousins, but parents were the scary part of the whole process. And, we used to run almost every year a coming out workshop. And we used to have quite a good crowd for that. We would get 20, 30, 40 people to a coming out workshop. And it was very easy to put on. We would get a representative group of people, you know, some gays, some lesbians. This was before transgender. Men and women, old and young, and each spend 5 or 10 minutes telling their story and where they were in their process. And then again, break for refreshments and go into small discussion groups. And if the people in the audience were in the midst of their own scary process, it was very supportive just to talk and meet other gay people. Yeah. Mm.
That's interesting. You mentioned the part before transgender. How did PFLAG added the transgender component?
That's a story. Again, I was so lucky. Our kid came out gay at a good time. I didn't mention I was one of 13 regional directors working out of the national office. The country was divided into 13 areas, regions, and I had a 5-state area, Virginia, West Virginia, Delaware, Maryland, and D.C. that I covered. And every 3 months, we would meet, the regional directors would meet in an air hub somewhere, Chicago, San Francisco, wherever, and trade stories and help educate each other in this process. And I had about 15 chapters in my region, and I traveled around to all of those every year. And I would try to support them and suggest other activities that they could get into and how they could strengthen their chapter and so forth. That was a really fun thing. A lot of travel, meeting wonderful people who were all, like myself, very dedicated and engrossed in the process at that time. So I was a regional director for about, I did two-year stints, and then I was off for a while, and I came back and did another year or two. I have a nice little gifty in my collection there for that. So, transgender. Our kid came out as a transsexual about 18 years after he came out as a lesbian. So, and he came out after his freshman year. He was born in 57. So he came out in about 75 as a gay. And he came out in about 1995 or 6 as a transsexual, at a time when most people had never heard of this and didn't know what to do. And the none of the gay organizations in the country were accepting of trans folks in their group. They were turning them away and saying, no, this is not the group for you. And our son called us from, he was living in Portland, Oregon, and he said, hey mom, what's wrong with this PFLAG chapter here? They kicked me out of their meeting. They wouldn't let me distribute a flyer about a transgender meeting. So I called the president of the Portland chapter. We got along fine, had a nice conversation. And not too long after that, we made a trip to Portland. We would go every year anyway to visit our kid. Our formerly leukemic son was in California, our gay trans kid is in Oregon and a daughter in Vermont. It's where they all still live. And so we went out and met the folks in that Portland chapter. And the president, who had a beautiful home, she was an artist, and it was filled with fascinating stuff, set up a special meeting kind of party for us. And we got to talk about transgender issues to that large chapter. And our kid and one of his friends and I think a third person all came and spoke from their own personal experience about what it was like coming out trans. So that's when I thought, oh, this is what we need to do, is to make PFLAG aware of and educated about and accepting of transgender folks. So I came back home and started working on that. And of course, luckily, I'm not too far from Washington. I could do it in 3.5 hours. So I started visiting the national chapter. The national director was very supportive of trans. Most of the staff was okay with it, but we had several brown bag lunches with the staff. And I developed a very dear friend, transgender male to female, in the D.C. area. And she would meet me, and then we would go together to the national office and talk with the staff there. And so then we started talking about how do we make the whole organization aware. And so then we started doing a national newsletter. And I developed a network within PFLAG, which we call the Transgender Network. And I organized it just like the chapter itself was organized. I got regional people who were either trans or straight but interested in trans issues in each of those regions. And then we all started recruiting a transgender representative for each PFLAG chapter. And there were then about 500 chapters. Some of them were teeny tiny, you know, two or three people meeting in Podunk somewhere. But there were 200 very sizable chapters meeting monthly and so forth. And I traveled a lot, and I, of course, was meeting with my PFLAG regional directors regularly, every 3 months. And so I was getting them to identify people in chapters. Eventually, we had transgender representatives, we call them T-cords, transgender coordinators, T-cords in 200 chapters. And my husband and I were putting together a newsletter, oh, maybe two or three times a year, and mailing it out to every chapter, all the national board members. And eventually we were getting the whole organization educated about transgender issues. I had maybe half a dozen close friends who worked hard on this with me. And then we met with the bylaws committee of the national board, and they drafted the changes that would be needed in the national bylaws to become officially transgender accepting. And then I arranged a transgender conference in San Francisco to meet at the same time as the national conference. And at that national conference, it was prearranged to vote on whether to change the bylaws to become transgender inclusive. And there were maybe about 500 people at that conference. And I was sitting near the back of the room, and I still get choked up talking about this, because when it came to a vote on accepting the change in the bylaws, every hand went up, except one fellow was across the aisle from me, and he just didn't vote. And there were no nays. There were nearly 500 yays. And that's how PFLAG became transgender accepting. And at intermission, I talked to the fellow who hadn't voted for it. And he said, well, Mary, I'm not against it. I just think we've got our hands full trying to get people to accept gay issues, you know, and gay people. So it was all right. I could accept one. What do you call it when they don't vote? Just a
absentee.
Whatever. We were the first national gay organization to become transgender inclusive. So then we started lobbying other gay groups. I went a couple of times to talk to the HRC staff, Human Rights Council. You're familiar with that group? That was, at that time, a very large, the largest gay group in the country.
Yeah, so.
And we talked to them a few times and a few other groups, and now it's just assumed. If you're a gay group, you include trans.
Do you think, partnering with other organizations was also part of that transition into not thinking about this issue of only gay and lesbian, but also transgender? And how did that help the community that PFLAG all over the country was, working with?
I'm not sure. What's the question?
Sorry. I was just wondering if, like, PFLAG influenced, how you said to talk about with other organizations and then spread that when we talk about these issues, you also include transgender. And how did that mirror to the people that would come to PFLAG, in Roanoke or in other places that you have been, to also be accepting of this new...
Well, I think the national groups gradually blended. There was at that time also quite a gap between the M to Fs and the F to Ms, and they are emotionally very different groups. You know, the male to female, they love to dress up and flounce around in their high heels and makeup and fancy clothes. And the female to male, they're more into sloppy, jeans and t-shirts and so forth. So there had to be a blending there as well as blending in with the gay groups. But I think at this point, although the differences still exist, they are not cause for any ill feeling or separateness. And yes, I think that having the meeting on the national level was important. I've been amazed, as everyone has been amazed, at how fast the country has moved towards gay acceptance and now transgender acceptance. I'm waiting to see what's going to happen in North Carolina with this bathroom issue. I don't understand why a bunch of female-to-male trans men haven't started using the ladies' room and waiting for the women to come screaming out the door saying there's men in the ladies' room, and for them to say, well, if you want us to take our pants down, you can see for yourselves that this is the gender we were born into, and that's what your law says.
Exactly.
So I think that's a law that just can't hold up. It's just it's going to be very difficult to enforce that.
No, I agree. Let's talk a little about your books and the material that PFLAG has distributed.
Okay.
I know that you won an award, the American Eagle, if I'm correct, award, with the Our Trans Children book. How did that, having this material and maybe other as well that you have contributed?
I'm not remembering the group you're talking about. I did get several nice awards, and I'll show you my little collection after we finish talking. But I became aware early on that there was no material that trans folks, for instance, could take to their parents or their families and say, read this, this will answer a lot of your questions. So one of my dear friends, Jessica Xavier, who lives outside of Washington and works now for the federal government on transgender issues, was actually the main author for this little booklet. But it was my idea, and I recruited Jessica to work on this, and we tried doing it by email, and her first draft read like a doctoral thesis. And we said, no, Jessica, this is for ordinary people. And I tell everybody, and then we discovered a better way to work even than email. That was in person. She came down for a weekend. And we went through this sentence by sentence and made it readable, you know. And we printed 10,000 of these. And we did it on, this is just one grade above newsprint. So we could do it very inexpensively. And we sold these for $3 for $3, $25 for $18, including shipping. And so we sent these out free to everybody. Later when I did my own book, I sent a free copy to 500 people around, you know. All the PFLAG chapters and board members and so forth. It's called priming the pump. Yes. So that's how this got started, and it still is a good, quick read for families who are just starting from scratch to learn about PFLAG. Now, we gave the copyrights of both these items to the national office. And they have rewritten this, and they now print out a beautiful, slick brochure that's, I don't know, $1.50 each, or two and a half each, or something like that. So they're not going to get the kind of bulk distribution that we got with these. When I would get a new edition printed, I would spend a couple of days counting out five of them, putting a rubber band around it. 25, 10,000 into bundles of 25, and then packing and mailing them as requested. And we made a little money on them, even at that inexpensive price, which is how we could afford other mailings like our T-Cord newsletter. T-Net newsletter to all our T-cords and all our chapters. The book, I was started going to transgender conferences, and gradually met a few other families and parents, particularly Karen and Bob Gross from Cleveland area, became very active, and realized that there was no substantial material that kids could hand their parents. And I was beginning to meet other families who were accepting. So I got them each to write 4 or 5 page chapters, little articles. And I collected those and edited them. I had to make them grammatically correct, but I didn't want to change the style, so I would kind of play around. I did a lot of email in those days. You know, I was corresponding with 40 different authors and 200 T-cords, and I was very busy for a few years.
I'm sure. You're doing wonderful work. You know, when we're talking about books, and we read a little bit about how PFLAG created a library. Could you tell us a little bit about that, and how was that helpful for the community?
Well, I would trade books whenever I went to a conference or buy other people's books, and they started coming out suddenly, lots of material. And so I brought them back, and our PFLAG chapter meetings, one of the members would carry a cardboard carton to every meeting with various kinds of books, and people could borrow those and so forth. So it was available to our members. And then there was a very, very wonderful guy, Ed Harrison, who was actually a Baptist, gay Baptist minister, Southern Baptist minister. And Ed started collecting a library. And that was available at this place on Grandin Road, where a number of health-type people and Tai Chi and massage and so forth offices are. And he had an office in a little library, a room in that building for a couple years. And then they needed that space for something else, and Ed died. And that library sort of folded up, and it was all packed up in boxes, and it was sitting in the Metropolitan Community Church for 20 years, and 15 years anyway. And I understand they have now finally made a library room in the church, which is again available. I don't know how much they're advertising it or how much it's being used, but I understand it is now there.
Absolutely. What do you think were PFLAG's most valuable contributions to the community?
Most valuable
contributions to the community?
I think the most valuable single thing is that we supported people who were then felt more comfortable coming out publicly as gay people. And I think that we could never have gotten the country to be as supportive as it is now and to pass positive legislation without a lot of gay folks coming out and saying, here I am, and I'm okay, and I didn't choose this, it chose me. I think for people to understand, I think the best analogy is like being left-handed. It's the way you're born. Now, you can be forced to learn to write with your right hand, as one of my brothers did. But it takes its toll emotionally, making that effort to do what's so easy for other people. And for people to understand that people don't choose to be gay, they are born. One of the things we used to say, if somebody was saying, why did you choose to be gay? I would say, well, when and why did you choose to be straight? And then they begin to understand it's just so natural. It's just got to be the way we are, you know. So I think it's the personal one-to-one contact that makes the biggest difference.
Absolutely. You mentioned PFLAG today has changed a little bit. Could you tell us about that? What is your involvement today with PFLAG?
Is there what?
What is your involvement today with PFLAG, if any?
I've gone to speak to the chapter a couple of times, but I no longer have wanted to be active. It has been a very nice, comfortable support group, and it is mostly gay and transgender folks themselves rather than family members, so the complexion of the group, I think, has been a little different than the original PFLAG emphasis. As it's in the title, it's families and friends of gays. So, and they're a very very nice group of people, and they support each other very well. But I haven't heard that they do much outreach or community-wide education or that sort of thing. I think they've been content to focus on support, whereas PFLAG was very strong on education and advocacy. Yeah.
Would you like to see more of that, or do you think that's more helpful, or do you think the situation now what do you think that has changed, I guess, and should there be more advocacy as well and support?
Well, you know, I personally don't want to be involved again. I have very low energy, and physically getting around is a little more taxing. I don't see as much need for it. I would like the city of Roanoke to adopt formally a transgender non-bias or not non-discriminating ordinance. Bill Bestpitch, one of the council members, is a friend of ours and goes to our church. And I've asked him a couple of times, Bill, when are you going to do this? And he says, well, Mary, we have to have some transgender folks come and ask us to do it. And of course, that's tricky, because if you're not out as a trans person, you have to out yourself in order to do it, and then you have no guarantee that the city's going to adopt it. So it hasn't happened, but I think it's not as crucial as it used to be.
It's speaking a little bit more in general terms, what direction do you see the LGBTQ community going?
I really don't know. I think we're over the hump, and I would have to ask them. It's more like the mopping up procedure. It's like there'll always be racial discrimination. And I think we just have, certainly in the police force, we've been made to understand that it's still a very critical problem. And I think there may be some areas in which transgender people are feeling discriminated against, but I'm kind of out of touch, to tell you. I've been content to lean back and let somebody else do it at this point.
Do you think the hardest part, it's over when you say we're over the hump? Do you think it's definitely better now than it used to be for the years you were active?
I think it's better in some parts of the country and in some cities like San Francisco and Provincetown and so forth, and tougher in some other areas where there just has to be more trans folks coming out and doing things, breaking down some barriers. I see movements as kind of like a wedge, and the people who are way out in front here are generally seen as kooks and crazy people, and they did things like chain themselves to the street barriers and whatever. But that was necessary to get awareness of the problem. Or like, what was the first riot in New York City?
Stonewall,
I'm trying to think of, which is now a museum. It was a violent reaction at that point, and they were seen as really strange people at that point. And then behind them come others who say, no, these are my friends and my sons and daughters. And then behind them comes a wider yet group. And when this wedge gets wide enough, then we can pass legislation. And then we still have to work on individual people who are not quite with it yet, you know. Legislation gets passed when probably three quarters of the public are in favor of it, the national legislature, but there's still that other 25% that you can only work on it individually. You can't pass laws to change people's minds and hearts. So it's an individual thing.
What do you think would you like to, I guess, a big message you would like to give to the next generation of activists? Like, you have been an activist your whole life, so what would be, you know, something that, from your experience, you would like them to know?
See, I think that the battles have been won for GLBT people. I think the next issues have got to be environmental. I think we've got to start saving the planet. And I personally am interested in the right to die. I wish you didn't have to be within six months of death anyway. I wish people could die whenever they are ready. So I guess I think it's almost time to move on to some other more pressing issues. In terms of our environmental problems, gay issues are not so pressing.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Is there anything you would like to add? Maybe anything I've missed?
Well, I would like to say that my husband and I, first of all, I couldn't have done any of this without a very supportive husband. He is a wonderful person, and he babysat kids at all ages while I went running around the country in local meetings, country meetings, all over, you know. So he's been wonderful. But it has opened up and broadened our lives and made life so much more fun, interesting, exciting. So we're really indebted to our kid for opening up a lot of doors for us. But I think also, at first I thought I was doing it for him. I was really doing it for me. I had a wonderful time, met a lot of wonderful people, got enough stuff printed and well enough known that it fed my ego very nicely. I met a lot of neat people in the process. One of the projects that National PFLAG did in conjunction with a conference in the D.C. area, we had our national conferences in different parts of the country, but when it was in D.C., the local chapter baked a bunch of apple pies, and we all went in groups of twos and threes and took an apple pie to every senator and said, "Gay is as American as apple pie." And in the process, we met John Warner and Barney Frank, Virgil Good. We talked to a couple times about gay issues. We were there when the last time the full AIDS quilt was assembled on the mall in Washington. And we looked for a quilt for the one Adrian had a close friend in high school who was also gay. And Tom had no quilt, so we came home and made a quilt for Tom. Talked to his family first and then worked on his quilt. So that was fun to do. Met Ellen. I rode up in an elevator one time with Ellen DeGeneres' mother and gave her one of my books. And she's a real sweet lady. Cher came to talk to one of our conferences, and I got to meet her and chat briefly. So, oh yeah, oh, and then one of the last big gay marches on Washington, this would have been 15 years ago, I guess, we got to speak from the platform, but everybody had taken too long, and we were very late in the day, and people were leaving, but nevertheless, we got to do our thing briefly up there on that platform. So we've just had a lot of fun. It has just enriched our lives immeasurably. We're indebted to all these neat gay people.
Do you think your son also grew throughout the process of, you know, like learning more about his own identity, and how you as well as your husband like learn about this process, and how you both were very involved?
He's been grateful to us, but he is not at all politically inclined. He says, "I'm no longer transsexual. I'm just a guy, and I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to be outed. I just want to live my life." And so he's now married to an Afro-American lady. And I think, well, how much diversity can one kid bring to the family? Gay, trans, interracial. So, yeah. But he's a great, great person. He's just very talented. He works full-time for IBM in the computer department without any training. He just picked it all up on his own. And he plays flute in a symphony on the West Coast. He grows almost all their own vegetables. He does all the family cooking. He is just a very talented, loving, smart, energetic, about as neat as they come.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the other two kids are pretty nice too. Our older son is also a computer person. And our daughter has a PhD in electrical engineering and leads a group at, it was IBM for years, but then her group's been sold off to another company. She's a neat lady. I met her in Amsterdam in April, and we went on a cruise up the Rhine River together. That was fun.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah. People say, oh, did you go alone, Mary? And I say, no, I took my walker.
Well, thank you so much. I don't want to miss anything because, you know, this is a wonderful story, a whole life of stories to tell. I think we covered
a lot.
Yes.
We covered everything on my little list, I think.
Well, again, thank you so much for sharing everything you share with us. We really appreciate it, and I'm sure the future will also appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your time and effort on doing this project, and you've both been very nice to meet and to work with. We thank you.
Well, likewise, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Sure.